Hello, I'm Dennis Palumbo. This is number 0597, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0597. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Peter Alessandria, who is a former lawyer who became an award-winning photographer. He's the author of Be Bigger Than You Think You Are. What led to the switch in careers?
I lost my law business in 2008, 2009 in the global financial crisis. And by the summer of 2009, it was clear that it was not going to come back anytime soon. And I think at one point I had read a book called Do What You Love and the Money Will Follow. And so I decided, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for me to do something. I certainly enjoyed being an attorney, but it was never my passion in life. And I thought, you know, if I'm ever going to do this, let me give it a shot. So it was at that moment that I decided to turn my hobby slash passion into my business.
Steve Kettman is the editor of a collection of essays about a post-Donald Trump world entitled Now What? This is a book that came together very quickly.
It kind of jumped out that, wow, if you could get people to just really sit down and capture what it felt like in November when finally the networks called it and, wow, we're really looking at the end of the Trump era, that amazing, complex, intense feeling that swept over people, that was the impulse. And so this was something we really scrambled to do in a hurry. It was 2 months from the time of having the idea and reaching out to people to having the finished book.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter honors the 46th President of the United States, Joe Biden, with his touching memoir about one of the most challenging and painful years of his life with Promise Me Dad. So let's hail to the chief right here. Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0597, is Dennis Palumbo, one of my favorite authors. He's the author of the amazing Daniel Rinaldi series of mysteries. He has 5 in the series so far, starting with Mirror Image, followed by Fever Dream, then Night Terrors, then Phantom Limb, and finally, Head Wounds. All of them are excellent reads. And you'll find a link to his website and also a link to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca for all 5 of his books on our website at thestufffile.com on the page he just mentioned. Yes, full circle. Thank you very much, Dennis, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Evidence shows 44-year-old Tony Whitman, a former soldier carrying a military-style rifle and wearing full tactical gear, did force his way into the building. Further, Whitman held an employee at gunpoint, telling the terrified woman, "Don't try anything or I'll shoot you," when she pleaded for her life. The community would be at risk personally of him committing further offenses if granted bail, declared Magistrate Greg McNamara in denying Whitman's bail request. No, this wasn't part of the invasion of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Whitman had raided the Lost Dogs home in Cranbourne, West Victoria, Australia, where his missing cat had been taken. Since it was after closing, Whitman was told he'd have to wait until the next day to pick it up. He apparently didn't want to wait. He allegedly tied up the clerk so he could go and look for his kitty, but the clerk managed to get free and call her boss, who called police. Whitman fled without retrieving the found feline, but returned in the morning to get it. Police were already there, documenting the crime scene. He was charged with kidnapping, false imprisonment, aggravated burglary, armed robbery, and firearm violations. An investigator found Whitman had been discharged from the Australian Army for failing to render efficient service. I'm guessing that lack of efficient service also included not being able to tie knots to secure a hostage. Anybody who has listened to this show knows what I'm going to say next. The cat put him up to it. Cats are evil. Little pieces of evil plotting against mankind.
Yeah.
The manager at Murdoch's Ranch and Home Supply in Bozeman, Montana, had bad news for a young man at the counter. No, they couldn't sell him any 9mm pistol ammunition because they didn't have any in the store. Ammunition had been in short supply all over the United States for months. 28-year-old Zachary A. Branson wasn't having any of it. He became verbally belligerent and swore at the manager. When a customer suggested he leave, Branson allegedly swept back his jacket, revealing a holstered pistol, which he then grabbed and began to pull out, but didn't pull it out completely. There's a joke there somewhere, but this is a family show. Shortly after, when another employee approached Branson's car to get its license plate number, Branson allegedly did the same thing to that employee, who then backed off in fear of his life. Police found Branson in a parking lot of a nearby Walmart and arrested him on a felony charge of assault with a weapon. At least the manager could be reasonably confident Branson's gun wasn't loaded, but here is my major question. The store manager said that ammunition had been in short supply all over the U.S. for months. Really? Exactly where has it all gone? During the pandemic, have people been hoarding ammo like toilet paper? And isn't that a reason for all of us to be just a tad concerned? Anyway, finally in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, while paramedics were on a call, a Texas man jumped into their ambulance and drove the vehicle, with its lights flashing, to a Jack in the Box where he ordered food at the drive-thru. 36-year-old Ronaldo Leonard was charged with felony theft in connection with the ambulance heist. The stolen vehicle was tracked to a Jack in the Box where Leonard was at the drive-thru ordering food with emergency lights ablaze. The restaurant is more than 4 miles from where the Houston Fire Department ambulance was stolen. In light of Leonard's prior criminal record, prosecutors have asked a judge to deny him bail. According to court records, Leonard's rap sheet includes separate felony convictions for PCP possession, robbery, and cocaine possession. Well, I can understand why he had the lights going. I mean, if you're hungry and you may be high on drugs, that can constitute an emergency. You know, the munchies and all. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Peter Alessandria is a professional photographer and a former entertainment attorney. He recently published his first self-help book entitled Be Bigger Than You Think You Are, Overcoming Our Self-Imposed Limits to Have the Life We Want. He joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Which came first, by the way, being a photographer or being an entertainment attorney?
Well, actually, it's a very interesting story. After law school, I moved to Los Angeles because I had a dream of becoming an entertainment attorney. I went to law school in upstate New York. And when I got to California, it was my first time being exposed to the creative process, to the filmmaking industry, photographic industry, and all of that. So I didn't pick up my first camera until probably 2002.
Wow. Was it always a passion of yours, or was this just a hobby you picked up at that time?
It was love at first sight. I picked up a camera and I just fell in love with photography. It quickly moved from a hobby to a passion.
And since you went through the whole lineage of becoming a lawyer, which I don't know what the impetus was for you becoming a lawyer. I don't know if it was something your parents wanted you to do. But when your family and friends heard, yeah, I'm leaving law behind, I'm going to take pictures, what was the reaction?
They're still recovering from that. they were a little surprised. But I came to a crossroads, Peter. I'll be honest with you. I lost my law business in 2008, 2009 in the global financial crisis.
Okay.
And I spent a lot of time trying to resurrect it. And by the summer of 2009, it was clear that it was not going to come back anytime soon. Now, having lived in California for many years, I kind of had that kind of new age, think positive mentality about things. And I think at one point I had read a book called Do What You Love and the Money Will Follow. And so I decided, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for me to do something. I certainly enjoyed being an attorney, but it was never my passion in life. And I thought, you know, if I'm ever going to do this, let me give it a shot. So it was at that moment that I decided to turn my hobby slash passion into my business.
So when did you go from reading a self-help book to actually writing one, the book being Be Bigger Than You Think You Are?
Yeah, so this is another interesting story, but this came about after, so basically what happened was in 2009, I moved my life back to the East Coast and I set up shop as a professional photographer. And for the first 3 years, Peter, I was stuck. I mean, nothing was happening. And at first I thought, well, you know, it must be the economy because the economy was still slow from the global financial crisis. And I thought, no, it's not the economy. It's the fact that I don't have a formal education in art or photography. And then I thought, well, maybe that's not it. It must be all the competition from the other photographers out there. And at one point I was even certain it was because I didn't have the latest and greatest camera equipment. Well, it turns out none of that was the problem. The problem was nothing outside of me. The problem was inside. The problem was basically I had a really negative self-image when it came to being a creative person. I was filled with fear of criticism, fear of rejection, filled with self-doubt, and all of that conspired to keep my life very small. And it was very difficult for me to start a new business in that state.
Was this something that you became self-aware of, or did someone have to point it out to you?
So I had started many years ago. One of the other benefits of moving to California when I did was there was a lot going on in what they call the human potential movement, spiritual growth, personal growth. And I started reading books and I started doing workshops and seminars and stuff like that. So I had some level of self-awareness, but it was amazing to me how deep the denial can run, because I was really unaware that what was running my life were these subconscious thoughts and beliefs about myself, which says, I'm not good enough, I don't have what it takes, nobody's going to like my work, I'm going to be criticized, I'm going to be rejected. And all of that negative thinking, which was under the radar, I wasn't consciously aware of it, was keeping me stuck. And it was at a certain point when I realized, gosh, maybe it's not the economy. Maybe it's not, you know, all the things I listed before. Maybe the problem is inside. That's when I started looking inside and I started taking inventory, if you will, of the thoughts and the beliefs that were running my life.
How long of a time frame did this process take place?
Probably started in late 2011 into 2012. And I really started doing a lot of introspection, and I started becoming more aware of these subconscious thoughts and beliefs that were running my life. And I embarked on a journey, if you will, of replacing all those negative thoughts and beliefs with more positive ones.
And how long was it before you started seeing positive results?
It was really within a few months. Basically, at that point, one of the first things I did was I started making cold calls for my commercial photography business. So there are three aspects to my photography work. One is commercial product photography, and that includes some architectural interior design photography. The second is portraits and headshots. I actually photograph a lot of executives, including a lot of attorneys. And my tagline for that business is, I used to be a lawyer, now I shoot them. sometimes they laugh. And then the third part of my business is my fine art photography. And those are my landscape, cityscape. It's actually mostly New York cityscape images. And one of the things that I do, which at least until recently was pretty unique to me and a select other group of photographers, was I track the moon over the New York City landmarks. I have an app that tells me where the moon is going to come up and where it's going to set. And I coordinate that with different landmarks like the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty, and so on. And I've created this collection of this really stunning, unique photography based on the moon in juxtaposition to these iconic landmarks.
Wow.
So now what happened? So basically I started looking at these thoughts and beliefs. And the most important thing was, Peter, I began to question all those beliefs that I just assumed were true. All the beliefs that says, you know, I don't have it. I went to law school. I've never taken a photography class. I never even took an art appreciation class in college. And I had to question those thoughts and say, well, maybe I don't need the education to actually show or to experience my own creativity and talent. So I started questioning all those thoughts and beliefs. And then I started using things like affirmations, vision statements, a vision board, guided visualizations to begin to reprogram all that negative thinking that says, I'm not good enough, I don't have what it takes.
So when did you come to the decision, not only that this was good for you, but you could put it in a book, the book being Be Bigger Than You Think You Are?
So it wasn't until 2019, I was actually back in California for the first time since I had left. And I was doing a lifestyle photo shoot for a product photography client in Los Angeles. And after that, I drove up to Yosemite to go to the national park to take some photos of the landscape up there. And I drove all the way up there. I got out of my car and I took about 5 steps and I tripped on, there was a hidden curb. I couldn't see it. I tripped. I didn't fall, but actually in that moment, I tore my calf muscle. And I was immediately rendered lame. I couldn't walk. I could barely drive. You know, the trip was basically over at that moment. But what happened was this thought popped into my head. Literally at that exact moment, when the pain was so great, I was seeing stars, this thought popped into my head, and that was, now you can write your book. Now, I had been thinking about writing a book for years because I really did. I mean, the basic story is I went from somebody who never won an award for anything in my life to somebody who's won more than 70 awards for my photography. I went from somebody who never imagined it was possible to see one of my photos published in a newspaper or magazine to someone who's had photos published in newspapers and magazines around the world. And from someone who never thought it was possible to sell one photo to someone who has sold and license my photos to collectors as far away as Australia. Wow. The only thing that changed, Peter, was my idea about myself, was how I saw myself, was who I thought I was. The original title of the book was, Who Do You Think You Are? Now, that came from a conversation I had many years ago. I was actually having, when I was still a lawyer, I was having an argument with somebody. And in the middle of the conversation, she stopped, she put her hands on her hips, and she looked at me and said, Who do you think you are? And it was meant as an insult, but Peter, that question stopped me in my tracks. I was like, oh my God, what a great question. Who do I think I am? Hmm. I may have actually said that out loud because she suddenly had a very confused look on her face. I never saw her again, but that question stuck with me. And I realize now that this is the most important question we can ask ourselves, because whoever we think we are is exactly who we're going to end up being in life. And it was only when I began questioning all those negative thoughts that most of the time I wasn't even aware of, but when I was aware of them, I thought, well, that's just the way I am.
Did you ever send the person that you had that argument with a copy of your book?
No, I haven't. Signed copy? I really lost track of her. But as I said, that question stuck with me.
I hope she walks into a bookstore one day and finds it and sees you on the back cover.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. The book is Be Bigger Than You Think You Are, Overcoming Our Self-Imposed Limits to Have the Life We Want. You mentioned the fact that you didn't go to school for film. I've always maintained, and I could hear it in your voice, you have a passion for what you do, and that passion alone will drive a lot of people's destiny towards what they want to be.
I agree with you 100%. However, I had something working against that passion. And what was working against me was this negative self-image, this idea that says, I'm not good enough. I don't have what it takes. Nobody's going to like my work. So it was only by reprogramming all of that. And the good thing about the book is it's set up as a workbook. So at the end of each chapter, there are exercises that people can do. The other thing I want to mention real quick is I do an online Zoom workshop every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. All are welcome. And I go through, we're going through chapter by chapter, we're going through the book. In real time, people are doing the exercises, asking questions. I'm talking about all the different topics. So that's open to anybody. They could find out more on my website, which is bebiggertoday.com.
So that's bebiggertoday.com. The Zoom conferences take place Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, correct?
Correct, yes.
And again, the book is Be Bigger Than You Think You Are. Peter, thank you very much for being a guest on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Peter Alessandria, author of Be Bigger Than You Think You Are, Overcoming Our Self-Imposed Limits to Have the Life We Want. He has two websites. One is BeBiggerToday.com, and the other is PeterAlessandriaPhotography.com. You can go to my website at TheStuffFile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0597, and you'll find links to both of Peter's sites, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the editor of the post-Trump book called Now What? Plus, Stuart Nellman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices, including Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few, and also several fine, fine radio stations around the globe. Okay, here's another helpful tip for you. If you're driving around with a large quantity of loose gunpowder in the front seat of your car and you get the urge to spark up a smoke, don't. That is, unless you're planning to make a homemade bomb, in which case, go ahead, light up. It is unclear whether Joseph Brennan of Massachusetts was planning to make a bomb. What is clear is that he blew himself clean out of the driver's door of his Toyota Camry when he lit up a smoke. A bystander heard the explosion from a block away and came running. He found Brennan, with singed hair and burns on his face, lying on the street next to his burning vehicle. "I'm an idiot," was the first thing Brennan allegedly told a bystander. "I lit a cigarette with gunpowder in the front seat." What Brennan was doing with loose gunpowder is unclear, but according to the bystander, he risked his life to go back to his wrecked vehicle, where he allegedly removed multiple items and put them in the trunk. This, of course, did not deter the police, who searched Brennan's car, where they removed 14 liquids and powders, some of which, when combined, could create what they called a destructive device. Brennan allegedly told police he had gotten various materials from a friend to tinker with. "I wasn't going to do anything malicious," he said. Police Chief Theodore Ross said in a statement that law enforcement searched Brennan's house and found precursor components, detonators, and one completed incendiary device. Although Brennan's Facebook page shows an interest in rocket propellants, so it is possibly harmless tinkering. Well, bomb or amateur rocketry, he certainly found a way to remove a lot of body hair. Yeah. A Florida man sent his own truck up in flames because he wanted to give deputies something to do. Deputies said they received reports of a loud explosion on December 18th and found a 2002 Chevrolet Silverado fully engulfed in flames. When authorities arrived on the scene, 28-year-old Kevin Murphy immediately admitted to starting the fire. He was placed in handcuffs, and when deputies searched him, They said they found a glass pipe used to smoke methamphetamine in his pocket and a folded-up dollar bill with traces of meth in his wallet. When questioned, Murphy said he wanted something for the sheriff's office to do and wanted to give himself an early Christmas present, so he set his truck on fire. He has a weird idea of what a Christmas present is. Murphy claimed he poured gas inside the Chevy's cab and under the truck, then created a trail away from the vehicle and set the fire. No one was injured, but the fire did cause minor damage to a nearby vehicle and building. Murphy is facing charges of second-degree arson, possession of methamphetamine, and possession of drug paraphernalia. You have to admire a civic-minded citizen who works hard just to keep authorities occupied. I mean, how selfless is that? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Florida man who wasn't on fire is charged with a felony after police say he sprayed himself with a fire extinguisher in an attempt to dry himself. Florida State University police found 54-year-old David Mann in a parking garage on Tuesday night with an extinguisher and covered in powder. Police say Mann told them he had been drinking, fell asleep, and then fell in water when he woke up. He said he was trying to dry himself off. Interfering with firefighter equipment is a third-degree felony. Wow, you know, if only he were around when Kevin Murphy set his Silverado on fire, then two people could have avoided jail. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? As you know, this show almost never talks about politics. We loathe to do it, really. But this is an interesting time in politics. In the United States, they have turned a page in history. President Donald Trump is out and President Joe Biden is in, and for a lot of people in the U.S., and for that matter around the world, the last 4 years was a hold-your-breath kind of moment. So, now what? Well, that's the title of a book that is edited by Steve Kettman, who is also the co-founder of the Wellstone Center in the Redwoods. The full title of the book is Now What? The Voters Have Spoken, Essays on Life After Trump. Steve joins us on the line from California. Hi, Steve.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to have you back on the program with us. So at what point during this 4-year term did you come up with the idea that this book needs to be done?
Just shortly before the elections, really. My wife and I had talked about maybe doing a book just looking at life in the pandemic. We don't publish a lot of books, but we have distribution through Ingram PGW in Canada and through the United States. And some of our books have made a nice little splash. We did a little book on walking, for example, by the former baseball manager, Bruce Bochy, that had a following. So we've been looking to follow up with a collection of personal essays. And that one didn't quite get off the ground. With the pandemic, it's been so hard to know what was coming next. But then with the end of the Trump era coming down the pike, it kind of jumped out that, wow, if you could get people to just really sit down and capture what it felt like, you know, in November when finally the networks called it and, wow, we're really looking at the end of the Trump era, that amazing, complex, intense feeling that swept over people then. And then, this week, again, a very similar feeling. That was the impulse. And so this was something we really scrambled to do in a hurry. It was 2 months from the time of having the idea and reaching out to people to having the finished book. That's how fast we did it.
How did you go about deciding who to reach out to?
Well, I've been had the pleasure of being on with you a couple times. I've been writing books for some years, and I cover a lot of ground, and I'm written for the New York Times and other publications. And I just kind of went to people that I felt would have something fresh to say. It wasn't necessarily that they were the best known people. For example, I remember when General Wesley Clark ran for president of the U.S. as a Democrat, way back, I think during the Iraq War period. And I happened to attend an event that he had done in New York, and I was just really impressed by the man. There was a real freshness to him. I reached out to him, and he and I have no personal connection, but he liked the idea. He was on board, and I thought he wrote a very nice essay. Some people, the writer Christopher Hitchens is well known. And one time I was on a flight from, I think it was New York to L.A., and this woman was sitting next to me, and probably like you, back before COVID when flying was more typical, I always avoid trying to chat with people on the plane because you never know once you start, you know, they might want to talk for hours. But she, this woman next to me had a New Yorker bag. There was just this vibe that she was a literary person, and I thought she probably worked at the New Yorker, and she did. And it was Antonia Hitchens, Christopher's daughter. And we ended up having a great conversation for 2 or 3 hours. And then through Hussein Ibish, who's another contributor to this collection in Washington, I reached out to Antonia, and she did an essay that's at the end of the book, and it was published by the Los Angeles Review of Books. But it's about 4,000 words, a very post-Joan Didion literary account of basically Trumpists in Beverly Hills that I thought was fascinating. So that's just a little snapshot example of how I basically just tried everything and then waited to see who wanted to do it. But don't want to talk too long, but just I was really struck that the first 8 people that I called to ask if they wanted to contribute all said yes, and all said yes immediately. It seemed that the idea tapped into something that everyone wanted to do, which is to try to use writing to come to terms with that which was so hard to come to terms with, this horrible sort of bottled up, emotion and angst and everything associated with the Trump years.
Now, as I'm sure you're aware, just based on the numbers of the last election, America is a country that is quite divided. A record number of people voted for Joe Biden, but also a record number of people voted for Donald Trump as well. So with that in mind, do you have any essays within the book entitled Now What that looks at the other side of things?
Well, it depends which other side. The Republican Party in the United States now has really, there's about 3 Republican parties, and one part is completely disconnected from reality. And that's like to the extent where if they thought that the Earth was in fact the center and, the sun moved around us, that's how disconnected they are. I don't feel that you can speak meaningfully to those people. But for example, Anthony Scaramucci was close to Donald Trump. He was in the White House as director of communications, not for a long time. I think it was 11 days, one Scaramucci of time. But, Anthony was always a Republican. He'd been a fundraiser for different Republicans. And, he writes an essay that tries to show a human side of Donald Trump, being in the Oval Office with him, talking to him about, looking up at the ceiling and the presidential seal. And doesn't it kind of give you tingles or something in that vein? So we offer that. And then we have an essay from Denver Riggleman, who was a congressman, a Republican congressman, up until earlier this month, and then had the temerity to speak out and say that Biden was president-elect, and had absolute, unbelievable abuse heaped on him. Even his own mother was very hard on him and called him a traitor to his own country. So Denver Riggleman is part of an effort to find a new way forward for the Republican Party. As far as all those votes for Donald Trump, I'd just point out that when Trump won 4 years ago, he called it a landslide. I think Joe Biden did win in a landslide. And I think that as we go through impeachment and a truth commission and let more people kind of come to grips with the magnitude of the deception that occurred in the Trump years, a lot of those people that voted for Trump the second time are going to be ready for a different kind of leader than that, I believe. That's my own personal conviction.
Is reading the book Now What supposed to be, in your estimation, a cathartic experience for those who have lived through the last 4 years?
Absolutely. And I would point out, I also lived in Berlin for 10 years. My wife's German. And I used to be, as you may recall, a hockey writer and was often in Canada, you know, many different cities. And I actually think this book is particularly good for people who aren't in the U.S. but also can't be not aware of trends in the U.S. and try to figure out what seems incomprehensible. It's incomprehensible to us as well. But these essays, as personal essays, dig deeper than a lot of what's called political analysis. And, you know, an example would be so many people talk about family members, you know, sons or daughters or fathers, and conversations that they've had over the years. I mean, Ken Korak, the voice of the Oakland A's, who's written a book for us, he wrote a lot about his father, who's in his 90s now and voted for FDR, and all that he's seen in politics. So by looking at the picture more through the personal and the immediate and what's an actual thought that occurred to you at a given time on a given day, I think it does move in a direction that leads to catharsis for people, and that really can help people move on and try to figure out, well, now what?
Since you say this is something that could be and should be read by those not just inside the country, but outside of the United States has taken a bit of a battering as far as their reputation worldwide has been concerned with the election of Donald Trump and through his presidency. Is this book also a soul-searching situation for those who have written in the book, and maybe also a sort of explanation to the rest of the world, a bit of a mea culpa, so to speak?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you have Christopher Buckley, son of William F. Buckley, founder of modern American conservatism, U.S. conservatism. And, you know, he compares Trump to Hitler in the first or second line and writes a very thoughtful, very pointed essay. That's an example. And I mentioned Hussein Ibish. He talked about the civil war in Beirut that he fled. And he said, watching a lot of developments in the U.S. looked very familiar to him. But he said, we're not where we were there. So he puts it in the kind of context that I think international readers could very much relate to. Jacob Heilbrun is editor of The National Interest, which, of course, was the journal of neoconservative opinion at one point. And he writes a fascinating essay that we almost published in Germany, because he talks about his parents leaving Germany, fleeing the Holocaust, his grandparents, but growing up with that all very much as part of his conception. And then I think it's safe to say really blames the neoconservatives for Trumpism, you know, or waves that idea around in a way that I think is quite intriguing. So the beauty of a collection like this with 38 different voices is, you know, no, I don't think any one reader is going to love all 38 essays, but someone looking for, it's almost like looking for handles to pick up, you know, some pot you pulled out of the stove or something like that, where this book has a lot of different handles, a lot of different ways in to things that feel fresh and intimate even at times, and I think might have a certain amount of haunting appeal. The San Francisco Chronicle just published a very positive review yesterday, and the writer there who's been around, she was a Middle East correspondent, Janine Zakaria, she mentioned that she sees this book as an important reference work for future generations looking back, trying to understand these times. And I think that that goes as well for current generations and future generations of our neighbors and friends. And I, for one, think that the United States has a lot of work to do, not just in making nice comments or rejoining different international agreements and bodies, but in getting our own house in order to show that we understand how close to the brink we came. And it could have gone another direction. Our democracy could have been down the drain, basically. And what would that have meant for the world? So I think a lot of us are still very freaked out about it. We feel the United States has a lot of work to do. And yeah, the book is meant to be part of that work. And anyone who buys a copy, you can reach out to me at Twitter, at Steve Kettman. It's that simple. Or a lot of the contributors are also on Twitter and other social media, and they definitely encourage you to read the essays and reach out to them directly with questions or ideas, concerns. We want this to be an ongoing dialogue and hope to continue it.
The book is Now What? The Voters Have Spoken, Essays on Life After Trump. Steve, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you. Always good to join you.
Steve Kettman, editor of the collection of essays entitled Now What? The Voters Have Spoken, Essays on Life After Trump. You can go to my website at thestuffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0597, and you'll find the links to Steve's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And coming to you directly from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, it's Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
What? Oh, sorry.
Did I wake you?
Yes, because I was having a nice little nap at the Lincoln bedroom.
The Lincoln bedroom? Okay.
Yes. Very comfortable, but I noticed it's quite a big bed, Peter.
Well, to you, any bed is quite a big bed.
Yes, that's true, but it's still nice and comfy.
Yeah.
They still maintain it very well since 1865, so I got no complaints here. But the one impression I get is that Abe Lincoln was one tall guy.
Yeah, and the hat didn't help either. And by the way, if he was just a tad shorter, things would have been different.
Oh, yes, indeed. Who needs that stovepipe hat for extra length? I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point there. But on this edition of Book Banter, Peter, we're not going to talk about presidential beds. There have been quite a few of those. But presidential books, and there's also been quite a few of those too, in particular written by Joe Biden, who took the oath of office as the 46th president of the United States. And many are familiar with Joe Biden's story of it and his road to the White House, his a career that's lasted since the early 70s, his years as senator from Delaware, and of course as vice president under Barack Obama's administration. But as well, people will also knew how he weathered many storms, especially the ones that affected his family, and especially his son Beau's battle with brain cancer, which claimed his life in May of 2015 at the age of 46. Now, as a way of healing from this massive personal loss, Biden wrote a memoir that was published 4 years ago about this difficult year of his life, and it's now, well, it's available in paperback, and it's called Promise Me Dad. Now, it's a chronicle not only of Beau's valiant battle with cancer, but also how he juggled, Joe Biden, that is, how he juggled that with his duties as vice president, because he had peacekeeping missions regarding the Ukraine, Iraq, Central America, and even the decision if he wanted to run for president in 2016, and how he used the power of prayer and family support to get him through all of, the personal stuff and also his duties, at the White House. Now, it's amazing. What I was very amazing about the book when I was reading it is Beau's courage and determination to try new treatments and innovative methods to try and beat the cancer, no matter how punishing the side effects were. And believe me, when you read this, there were plenty of punishing side effects, especially one treatment that they actually injected an actual virus into his brain that was in the test stages. But the book I found was a very honest, very sensitive, touching account of how a disease can affect not only the victim, but the family too. And but also shows what makes up the character of Joe Biden, the family man and the public servant, as he's now taking up the biggest job of his career.
We should also mention the reason why the book is called Promise Me Dad.
Yes, because as Bo was diagnosed, after he was diagnosed with brain cancer, he had a meeting, the two of them had a little private meeting together, and Bo said, no matter what happens to him, he said, promise me, Dad, that you'll be okay and everything will be all right. She's going to promise me that you will be okay. And that was a solemn promise that Joe made to his son during this very difficult time and the road ahead as well.
And we should also mention the type of cancer that took him away is also the same type of cancer that took John McCain.
Yes, glioblastoma.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very aggressive form. One day it'll be eradicated, but very aggressive.
Absolutely.
Well, like I said, it's a very, you know, it's almost like a pre-presidential memoir when you think about it, because it just mixes, like I said, the personal side and the vice presidential side. And, you know, you see how prepared he is to be the president, because he had training as the VP.
I mean, we know not only from the book, but from hearing him talk about his son, just from hearing him talk about the trials and tribulation he went through with the loss of his daughter and his first wife. Again, the problem with Bo. We learned just how religious he is. And it's interesting when you consider he's only the second Catholic to become president of the United States. And remember the firestorm when the first Catholic president became president?
Yeah, during the 1960 campaign, there was a big brouhaha over Kennedy's Catholicism. They all thought he had a connection with the Pope and the Pope was going to tell him what to do. And he said, yes, I'm Catholic, but it's that, you know, my Catholicism is not going to rule the way I, you know, do the job as president.
Yeah. Anyway, so the book again is?
It's called Promise Me Dad. It's by Joe Biden and it's published by Flatiron Books, and it's $23.50 in trade paperback.
And what other books do you recommend in this genre, sir?
Well, I was thinking of two books that were written by past presidents before they did become president. So speaking of John F. Kennedy, we have his Pulitzer Prize-winning 1956 book, Profiles in Courage, which he wrote while he was senator from Massachusetts. And Barack Obama's first book, Dreams of My Father, which recounted his early life and the life of his dad, which he wrote while he was senator from the state of Illinois.
Interesting. So two books written by senators, one book written by a vice president, all leading toward the White House.
Yes, exactly. That's the thread.
Interesting. So again, this book is?
It's called Promise Me Dad by Joe Biden. It's published by Flatiron Books, and it's $23.50 in trade paperback.
And by the way, is the company Flatiron Books called that because it's in that iconic New York building?
Well, the logo is the Flatiron Building from New York. So, yeah, you got it right.
I love that building. That is such an iconic building in New York City. Okay, so the book is Joe Biden and the book is Promise Me Dad. And we have to give a shout out to your late dad. Say hello to Norm. Promise Me Dad.
Yes, I will. And I think he's probably, you know, right now having a gin and tonic waiting to play golf.
Norm was a fun guy. I got to admit.
Yes, he was.
A fun guy. Anyway, how can we find you, Mr. Nellman, sir?
Well, you won't find me in the Lincoln bedroom or the Roosevelt room for that matter, but you're going to find me in the pages of the Montreal Times every week in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I've got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, I know there are some of you out there who just love squirrel stories, so here we go. A Toronto woman captured video when she looked into her backyard and was confronted with a bizarre sight, a squirrel holding a knife. Andrea Diamond, who lives in the Rosedale area of Toronto, said squirrels are a common sight in her backyard, but Wednesday morning she spotted a squirrel that had picked up a paring knife that she left near a tent outside her home. So apparently, knife-wielding squirrels are a thing now, Diamond tweeted, along with footage of the squirrel. She said the rodent gnawed on the knife handle for a while before abandoning the tool. She said the animal returned a short time later to chew on the knife a little longer. Diamond said the squirrel did not appear to have injured itself with the sharp object. I got a question for Andrea. If it was her paring knife that she left outside and the squirrel was chewing on it, then dropped it, why didn't she go out and retrieve it before the squirrel came back to it? And by the way, for those of you who are looking to chart urban evolutionary life, at the lower rung you have rats, then rats with wings, that would be pigeons, and finally rats with better PR, that would be squirrels. Collectively, the word is vermin. And a 28-year-old man was arrested after snoring loudly and apparently sleeping behind the wheel in a McDonald's drive-thru lane in Florida. The case of the dozing dude began at about 3:47 a.m. December 20th when an Indian River County Sheriff's deputy went to a McDonald's for a suspicious vehicle. McDonald's does not have a sleep-through lane, in case you're wondering. The man woke up and the deputy asked for his license. "I don't have one," he is quoted as saying. Of course, they never do in these stories. His Ford pickup smelled of booze and his speech was slurred. The man, a Fort Pierce resident, participated in field sobriety exercises and was arrested on charges of DUI and knowingly driving with a suspended license. He told investigators he'd imbibed 6 to 8 beers at a bonfire and also had Rum Runners, a cocktail involving rum. I'm assuming that he was able to only be arrested for sleeping at a drive-thru because he was, how would we say this, light enough. Just a guess on my part. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment we've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
If you listened to this show last week, then you know the idiot of the day was gold-winning Olympic swimmer Cleet Keller, who at 6'6" was wearing a USA Olympic team jacket while he was one of the morons storming the U.S. Capitol building back on January the 6th. I honestly didn't think I was going back to the scene of that crime, but here we are, just a mere 1 week later, with news of another arrest from that fateful day. Brian Betancourt, a self-proclaimed white supremacist from Maryland, who was on parole for burglary, has been arrested in connection with the riot at the U.S. Capitol. The Silver Spring resident, who has been convicted of fourth-degree burglary, was on probation when he asked for and received permission to travel to D.C. to sell Bibles with an organization called Gideon International. So, how do we know he was actually at the riot? Because, since he was on probation, he was fitted with an ankle bracelet, monitored by authorities who use computer software to track his movement. A screenshot of the program shows he apparently ventured in the direction of the White House ellipse, where President Trump rallied his supporters, before moving to the area in front of the Capitol, where he remained from 2 to 5 p.m. And if that wasn't enough, there was a social media post where he appears to stand on scaffolding erected on the western side of the U.S. Capitol building, holding the corner of a Confederate battle flag. It also shows him wearing what appears to be a Proud Boys t-shirt and flashing the OK hand signal, which is commonly used by white supremacists. Doesn't anybody who claims to be a white supremacist not get the irony of the fact that in their case, that term is usually an oxymoron? Because why? Oh, why? If you're planning to run off in a fit of political insurrection against your own country, would you do so while wearing an ankle monitor that is already being tracked by the authorities? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0597. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links in all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0597. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.